The subject for this morning is the elements of perfection. We have seen that this perfection has two aspects. One, the purification of the being, the soul, and its freedom from involvement in nature. There is also the aspect of the release of nature from the hold of dualities, from the play of the modes, the three modes, the gunas. Both these movements have to be worked out before it becomes possible to achieve something of the perfection that is envisaged. Perfection consists, as we have seen, of two steps: purification and freedom. These are not exactly successive steps, but more or less simultaneous. Purification has always to be done limb by limb, part by part, and with each step of purification firmly taken, there is an appropriate release of the part so purified from the elements that deform its movements. When both nature and soul have been subjected to this process of purification to a reasonable extent, and there is a feeling in consciousness, awareness of some liberation from the stranglehold of lower nature, then comes the importance of having the right conception of the divine being, the divine nature in which one seeks to grow. For it is understood that there can be no perfection as long as we are confined to the lower being, the lower formulation of being in which we are imprisoned at present. We have to conceive of the ideal divine being and nature, according to which we have to mold ourselves, our soul and our nature. And according to our conception of the Supreme, of the divine being that we want to attain, is the starting point, the process, and the aim of our sadhana. There is the traditional view which looks upon the divine being as a soul reality, but excluding the universe. The universe, they hold, is something that has somehow come to be against the white purity of the divine reality. That reality, exclusive of these lower formations or deformations is the only reality. It is an impersonal, aloof, uninvolved reality. If this is accepted, the yoga, the practice and the discipline that is undertaken to achieve this objective is in the traditional line of the yoga of knowledge or the Vedanta. There is again the conception so familiarized with the Buddhist thinkers of looking upon the divine being as something immensely negative, denying all permanence to the world and to things that we see. The whole world is looked upon as something impermanent, without any sustaining being, real being, whether in the universe or in the individual. All is looked upon as a kind of continuation a stretching out of it, of thread of thoughts and ideas woven round desires, each desire succeeding another, each desire giving rise to certain movements and so on. So the whole approach is negative, and the ideal status that is recommended is so negative that everything is supposed to be dissolved with the dissolution of desire at its roots. There are again approaches which conceive the divine as the Lord of love. The seeker practices a discipline, a ninefold discipline, to which we have already referred in our studies on the way of love. And the devotee builds himself into an image of his beloved, and at his best he loses himself in the being of the beloved, the Lord. Either he attains a likeness or he approaches a closeness. It is called sadrishya or samipya. In all these approaches, the stress is on moving away from the world, on denying the reality of the universe, any objective for life on earth, and emphasizing the necessity of withdrawal. This clearly is out of question for the seeker of the integral truth, which embraces both the reality in itself and the reality in and as the world. The seeker aims not only at achieving a certain identity of his individual being with the divine being in his consciousness, in his nature, but also at putting out this attainment, this identity attained, in his movement in life. For him, there is no inside different from outside. He looks upon all life as one, the soul and nature also as two statuses of the reality. And his discipline, his yogic practice is aimed at achieving this unity of life, unity basing the multiple manifestation of the reality. To achieve this integral objective, the discipline that is described by Sri Aurobindo consists of six elements. The first element is one of equality. The Gita has already familiarized us with the conception and the necessity of cultivating a poise of equality, whatever our field of life. Life consists of a series of impacts, some of which are welcome, some of which are not, some of which we like, some of which we don't. Now this interplay of likes and dislikes, of the pleasant and the unpleasant, they always evoke in us, each time they make an impact, of corresponding reactions, corresponding responses of welcome or repulsion. Thus we are at the mercy of every impact, of every contact that comes upon us, whether we will or do not will for it. The first and indispensable attitude that we have to build up is one of equality. And before we build up equality, we have to acquire a certain indifference. Indifference is the first step, which is gradually changed into an attitude of equality. Nobody can have an attitude or a front of equality in the beginning. One always begins with a mental understanding that this is so and this is not so. This is what I have to do. But our nature is accustomed to respond in a particular way. Even if the mind knows, still we cannot help. The heart, the lower nature, the emotions, even the physical body responds in a way to which it is habituated. The mind has to impose its will and begin with introducing what we may call a stoic indifference, endurance, without reacting. The next step is, when this is fairly well stabilized, to bring in a positive attitude of equality, whether it is a welcome contact or an unwelcome. One does not simply react. One takes it that it has to be gone through and accepts it as such. One doesn't shrink. One does not rejoice either. This attitude of equality is again of two kinds, passive and active. The passive equality is when we do not return any kind of response or reaction, but deal with things in matter-of-fact ways, do things because they are to be done, without mental reactions. Once this state is attained, passive equality is established in our being, the next inevitable step is to have an active equality. An active equality means to take each contact, establish our strength upon it, and take treat it as a field of experience, link it to our own progress, utilize it in the best possible spirit, and in the process draw what we may call the sap of the experience. Each experience, in whatever way it impacts upon our surface being, contains elements that promote the progress of our soul. If we are sufficiently objective, we can seize each experience and draw the rasa from it. And the active quality consists in drawing this rasa of experience. This benefit of experience from every contact that you come across, there is what the Gita calls a positive samatha. The Gita even goes to the extent of equating this equality with the whole of yoga. But the yoga that we envisage is something more enlarged with a greater application. So as a first step, this yoga of equality is prescribed. The second element is, it is a self-evident truth that we do not have or wield that amount of power, force or energy that we would need in every situation. We know what we want to do. We know what our even desires want us to achieve. But very often, most often, we lack the necessary means, we lack the necessary power, because we are content to function within a series of limitations. And these psychological limitations entail certain practical inconveniences, practical dwindlings of power that we would otherwise exercise. This inability to function at our optimum, this lack of power to achieve what we want, this is the second thing that has to be remedied. And that can be done only by opening ourselves, our whole being, or at least the concerned parts, to the higher power of nature that is active in the universe. Normally we are shut up within the walls of our own ego and the power that can be exercised within those walls. If by some means or discipline we succeed in opening our doors and windows to the inrush of the higher power, the larger powers in the universe, we get hold of a power that derives from a higher source, not from the lower nature. This awakens what is called the inherent capacity of our limbs, of our soul and nature. Each soul and therefore each nature organized around that soul has its own temperament, has its own shape or form or mold in which it is to function. It is called the svabhava or self-nature. And each person, each soul, as it grows, has to find ways and means of expressing itself, of moving into action according to the temperament that has been decided for it. that has been chosen by it earlier. And this becomes easier when one is open to the working of the higher Shakti, the higher power. All these three, the awakening of the inherent capacities, the functioning according to its self nature, and the achieving of things with a power that is not normally available to one. This is the second composite step of this discipline. In so doing, we open to what may be called the higher or the divine nature. The individual nature yields to its corresponding part in the multiple divine nature and changes its character. It enlarges itself, it deepens itself, and though the outer form may remain the same, the content gradually changes. To do this more effectively, one needs to have what may be called the faith, shraddha, faith that one has power, that one can link oneself with a higher power by invoking it, and one can wield that power to fulfill the demand of one's soul in the pattern that is natural to its mold. There is, however, a certain limitation. As long as we function within the range set by our limited ignorant mind, all these things can be done only up to a certain extent, severely limited by the limitations of the mind. In our yoga, however, one does not stay in the mind, however enlarged the mind may be. One has to go beyond the mind. There are several gradations extending beyond the mind, all of which culminate in what Sri Aurobindo has called the Gnostic mind, where the inherent limitations of mind are overcome and their opposite terms of perfection are founded. After these preliminary movements have been set afoot, one has to intensify the yoga to render the mental life into terms of the Gnostic life, the vijnana or the divine knowledge. It is only in proportion as the power and the will of the divine Gnostic consciousness begins to permeate the mind, inform its movements, uplift its levels, that the perfection of equality, the perfection of power, the putting on of the divine nature, making faith a dynamic power, irresistible power, these become more and more possible. With all that, however, there are other elements of the being. There are the emotions. There is what is called the psychic prana. the life force which is open to the impulsion of desire, and there is the physical body. It is possible that on the heights of the mind or the heights of consciousness, we act and move in the spirit of perfect equality, wielding the highest power, reacting in terms of the divine nature and so on. But these lower members, unless they are also treated to the light of the Gnostic consciousness, they continue to react in the same old way. So the important thing at this stage is to bring the law of the supramental or the Gnostic Purusha to function within the physical body, which is the foundation, which is the base of the whole edifice. The roots of our ignorance, the roots of dragging us down, the roots of the imperfection that drag us down, they are all in the subconscious or the inconscient parts of the physical body. The rays, the influence, and the working of the Gnostic Purusha, the Vijnanamaya Purusha, who in his higher levels reveals himself as the Anandamaya, the Delight Purusha. That rule has to be established in the physical. And how is that to be done? For that purpose, we must open to the knowledge that the physical body that we see is not all. Behind the physical body is a subtler existence which is divided into so many sheets for sake of mental understanding. But for our purpose at the moment, let us conceive of this subtle existence behind the physical body as the mental body, the body of the mental Purusha, and behind it the spiritual body or the causal body which houses the Gnostic soul, the delight soul. And it is from these subtler bodies, the causal body, spiritual causal body, or the mental body inside, behind, that the powers of the divine nature, the divine consciousness, begin to percolate in the physical body. The physical body has to be so disciplined, so purified, that it is set in tune with the vibrations of the subtler bodies inside. And to do that, one must first admit the existence of those bodies, refine the movements of the physical body so that they can express and hold the vibrations of the purer and the subtler bodies. This is what is called purification. And it is in this process of the gradual opening of the physical body, physical consciousness, to the action of the inner, subtler existence, the body of the mental Purusha or the spiritual body of the Gnostic and the delight Purusha. In that process, that new faculties release themselves, unveil themselves, what are called siddhis, the 8 siddhis in yoga. And these, Sri Aurobindo points out, they can be achieved or realized purely by Hatha Yoga, by physical means, like taking up postures, breathing exercises, exerting pressure on those centers of the body behind which these powers lie latent. But in our yoga, this pressure is not exerted as in the tantric system or in the hatha yogic or raja yogic from below. But the higher pressure, the force of the higher consciousness, as it works, it throws open the various centers, and certain of these powers, certain of these siddhis, they reveal themselves and function as natural movements. They are no more siddhis, they are no more wonder powers, because they unveil themselves, they arise only when the consciousness to which they are natural, that consciousness is formed. In the traditional yogas, there nobody bothers about it. They want to excite and activize these latent powers, but they will deal with them only from the normal consciousness. That is why if to them it appears, and to those who have ordinary consciousness who see, it appears that they are miracle powers. But for a person who has got that consciousness, of which these are normal powers of functioning, they don't appear miraculous. So where is the question? Sri Aurobindo asked elsewhere, of asking a yogi not to exercise these powers because they are a danger, they are a snare, they are a temptation. For him, he is just not conscious or aware that he is doing something wonderful. This is what is likely to happen on the way, these powers revealing themselves as the lower being, the physical being is taken up and assumed in the higher nature. When all this is done, one inevitable result is that one takes to action. One doesn't shut up oneself in the attained identity with the divine or the Brahman. One moves into action with that consciousness, with the power or powers that have unveiled in oneself. And as one acts with that consciousness, one derives that delight, one draws that enjoyment, certainly not for oneself, because that oneself, that ego self, which appropriates that joy and enjoyment for itself, has long been exploded. There is only a divine center, and the individual is conscious that he is acting as an instrument, as a channel of the divine. And the enjoyment that he takes, or rather that comes to him in the very act of moving into action, that goes to the divine enjoyer. And this is possible in its perfection only at a Gnostic level. Till then, that joy, that enjoyment, that knowledge, that sense of power one can have in a sort of a reflected way in the mind, in a kind of a derivative way in the mind. But as one changes from the mental consciousness into higher grades of consciousness, one becomes aware of a masked and illumined consciousness, what the Upanishad describes as the Chidghana, the massive, the illumined consciousness, which has this capacity to take the enjoyment for the divine, to act, to put out its forces for the divine, all the while on the basis not of oneself being separate from the divine, of oneself being separate from the world, but of unity, of oneness there is one Brahman, that is the basic awareness, that all is Brahman, that all is the divine, and that the divine is not exhausted, is not, he does not comprise only these things, but he is infinite, he is much more. So the divine is one, the divine is all, the divine is infinite. All these are simultaneous verities that come to life in the consciousness that one attains, the Chidghana, or the mass, the illumined consciousness, which reveals itself as one, but one poise of the Gnostic consciousness, even as that same Gnostic consciousness, as we move still upwards, it melts into the consciousness of sheer delight. Consciousness force. Same. Consciousness as force, that is Shakti. Consciousness can remain self-aware, static. Consciousness can reveal itself in its dynamic aspect, and that force of consciousness is called Shakti, puissance.
And how is the difference
in
the working between Shakti and light?
Light. In light, the element of awareness, consciousness, is more. In Shakti or power, the dynamic element is more, and the element of illumination is held behind. Normally, the Shakti has been deformed, reduced, or you can say, veiled as an operation of Prakriti. As Prakriti is purified, purified of its gross elements, and it increases in consciousness and realizes itself to be a movement of consciousness, the Prakriti changes into Shakti. So what is Shakti there? In our triple world of ignorance, it is Prakriti. Prakriti, Sri Aurobindo explained somewhere, is the outermost executive aspect of the Shakti. When you go within, deeper and deeper, you find that it is nothing else than Shakti. Only it being on the outermost levels, it has acquired all that encrustation of ignorance and limitation. The pure divine Shakti has no limitations. It may observe certain limitations of circumstance, of environment, but it is not obliged to function under any limitations. The limitations that it chooses are self-chosen.
Is there any relation that what is opening towards the divine and different chakras describe in Bhagavad-gita?
When the body opens to the divine, the response of the divine consciousness or the divine force of consciousness may awaken or may not awaken certain chakras in the body. If certain parts are more developed, it is possible that those parts, when they respond, those chakras also blossom. And you feel the precise action, intensified action of the powers that are localized there. But it is not always necessary. It is not that in every case the chakras will open. What is important and what happens is the powers that are behind that chakra, they are released into action. So even without feeling a physical change, as envisaged by the tantrics, the work may be done. For instance, the center of knowledge, the center of love, the center of expression, these things, without saying that the chakras are opened, those powers may start functioning. One gets sudden faculty of poetry. A painter or an artist, his faculties blossom. That is because something here in the Ajna chakra has opened, he sees the vision. Something here in the throat, the expressive center, that has opened, he started expressing. But when we open, we do not put any pressure upon any center or any chakra. Whatever happens in this yoga by way of opening of the chakras is involuntary. In other yogas, it is a willed operation. How the body opens to the divine. The thought or the idea of opening to the divine is imposed upon the body by the mind. After all, mind is the leader of life and body in every human being. Prana sharira neta. So we start, whether it is in karma yoga or bhakti yoga, jnana yoga or whatever kind of yoga, we start in the mind. Even when we think of the divine, first there is imagination. We read books, we conceive. The conception may be correct or not correct. Imagination may be wild or it may be regulated. Whatever it is, you start in the mind. So when we want the body to participate in yoga, to awaken and to open to the divine, we first will it mentally. We impose that idea or that thought upon the body, communicate it consciously that this body must respond to the divine force, must learn to awake and aspire for the divine possession of it. So that each time when we take food, for instance, when we take exercise, for instance, when we take bath, for instance, when we have anything to do with the body, mentally we inject at each time, this is for the God, this is for the divine. This body must be prepared, this body must learn to respond to the divine vibrations, to serve the divine. At present it is serving my desire, at present it is serving my ego. It should learn to surrender itself to the divine master, to the divine mother. When you take food, tell the body that you are, take this food. This is a consecrated food. First you consecrate it to the divine. And then tell the body, it is consecrated. It is made available to you.
so that you assimilate it and grow in the spirit of the divine. So that way, when you do exercise, we must not only go through the muscular movements, but be conscious that the element of consciousness in the muscles must be awake, so that even when our mind is not turned here, that consciousness functions, and that there is such a consciousness in our physical cells. All of us know how, when there is some danger, without our knowing so much mentally, there is an immediate shrinking, a reaction. So it is there. Question is of tapping it, of articulating it more and more. The all has to start with exertion or putting a will on the body that you shall be awake, and naturally you respect the body. You don't treat the body as a slave, but as a rich possession given in your hands by the divine. After all, you can do things only as long as the body is there. So one must learn to respect the body. Not become a slave of the body, but respect the body. Treat its minutest intuitions, minutest communications with due respect. If the body intuits something, you must not ignore it. You must see what it is, what it wants. So we have to spend a certain time in the culture of the body, culture of the body consciousness, and orient it towards the divine, even as we do the same thing with the mind. We turn the mental thoughts to the divine, we read what is related to the divine. That way, the body also must be engaged in movements and activities that take you to the divine and not away from the divine. So when the work of the body, the nourishing of the body, the growth of the body, all of these are organized around that central objective, the body participates in the sadhana with much more readiness than the life force, which is always a recalcitrant element until the last stage of perfection has been reached.